Revenue Committee for the 29th of May. Maz and I have talked. We'd like to move this committee outside. We can take a vote of the audience to do that. We have one bill up today. We're not going to go into work session on this bill, but we're going to hear a couple of amendments on House Bill 2299. And with that, I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2299.
Mazin. Mr. Chair, members, one member of the committee, House Bill 2299 came to the Senate Revenue Committee as the B engrossed version, which means it went through several iterations of amendments. The bill, in its face, it deals with the economic development issues, what it reduces minimum investments needed to qualify for the SIP or the Strategic Investment Program, tax exemptions for that. It changes that program for projects located in the rural areas. In the same time, allows special districts to opt out of these exemptions. And it grants authority to the Oregon Economic and Community Development Commission to establish criteria for projects that are eligible for exemptions, revamps enterprise zone property tax exemptions, modifies application and annual claim procedures, reduces minimum investment needed for the long-term enterprise zones, and it modifies the scope of investment that qualify for the electronic commerce zone. And finally, one of the things that it got added in the House, it allows local enterprise zone sponsors to offer exemptions on annual basis under certain criteria once those criteria are met. And also the exempt centrally assessed properties in enterprise zones. The general background about this bill, Mr. Chair, is that the tools available for the state for the economic development are classified in the most general of sense as five. Three of them are being revamped in this bill, but the other two is a small city program. This was the subject matter of House Bill 2298, and of course many would argue that the urban renewal process is in itself emerging to be an economic development tool. This leaves this bill with dealing with the three other tools, the strategic investment program, the short-term and the long-term enterprise zones. However, in general, this bill would deal with five issues out of those three, or coming out of these three. The strategic investment program, as you know, it has been the program that brought the large investments to the metropolitan area in the 90s with the billion-dollar type investments that we saw with the semiconductor industry coming to the Oregon and mostly the metropolitan areas. This bill would try to craft this program to suit the rural areas by going down with a threshold of exemption on taxes from the starting after, or taxes being collected after the first 100 million to taxes being collected after the 25 first millions. So the first 25 million pays tax, after that it will be exempt. There's also, in addition, the community service fee. This community service fee is a payment about 25% of the foregone property taxes, up to $2 million in the case of the original strategic investment program. And this new program for rural projects, it's $500,000 that the community service fee would is suggested to be.
Mr. Chair?
Mazen,
I just want to clarify one thing. You said that the they want to lower the taxable threshold to $25 million, and then above that the taxes are exempt?
Yes, sir.
So after they have paid $25 million, in what type of tax?
$25 million of the investment, Mr. Chair. If a firm invests, let's say, $400 million in somewhere outside in the urban on the rural project, the first $25 million of that investment is subjected to taxation, and above that, it's not.
Okay.
In addition...
And we're talking about property tax.
That's correct. In addition, for 15 years, that is.
For 15 years?
Right. The addition is a community service fee is about... up to $500,000 or 25% of the foregone property taxes if it's less than $500,000. The bill also offers a choice for the special districts to opt out, and that was put as part of the amendments on the House side. The second main issue that the bill deals with is enterprise zones. This bill has been in progress or in process for a while. It seems that many agencies and other stakeholders have been meeting in order to reorganize and realign the enterprise zone statutes. How are they designated, management of the enterprise zones and termination of them and so on. And that would be the second main issue the bill would deal with. And also, within that section, qualifies hotel, motel, and resorts to be eligible businesses or eligible zone businesses. Out of the enterprise zones, of course, there is the two types. The short-term exemption of enterprise zones are the exemptions of 3 to 5 years. Exemptions from property taxes. This bill cleans up and puts together all the processes in place, allows abatement and combined enterprise zones, and it gets into the issue of utilities being eligible in the enterprise zones, and it deals with an issue that has received a great deal of discussion, which is a construction and process that you probably we will talk about with the amendments that you have in the packet. The second policy issue that was amended in the House was the opening of the window for the local sponsors to allow a business who have not been able to get the exemption in the first year to apply and get those exemptions in the years after that. That was a new addition. Also, the short-term enterprise zones now are being changed from the 10% increase in employment to a 10% increase in productivity. And productivity is measured by hours of labor, by the production of what these hours of labor do. So that, in a way, gives more flexibility for companies to be able to apply and qualify for the exemption.
Mr. Chair?
Senator,
and just explain that again, please, how they measure productivity?
It'll be the amount of product by how many labor hours there are. So if you have 1,000 labor hours producing, let's say, 10,000 units, and then the year after there is an increase of 10% of that productivity, then that qualifies.
So let's say they have X number of employees, they buy some computer systems, that increases productivity, that could qualify for this, even though they're not hiring anybody additional.
That's correct.
Can I further question? I mean, what's the rationale behind that? If the purpose of an enterprise zone is to stimulate investment to create jobs.
We'll have the departments.
Okay.
Enough math.
Okay.
If you want to touch what the rationale is.
Well, there could be many rationales.
We can wait for the department.
We could discuss even more. The final two issues, Mr. Chair, is the long-term enterprise zones. Those are extended 2 years from sunsetting in 2004 to 2006. Also, it opens the investment requirement, or lowers the investment requirement in the geographically remote sites of the I-5, 10 miles away from the I-5 remote sites, to $12.5 million in order to be able to qualify for this long-term enterprise zone, which is 7 to 15 years of property tax exemptions with the ability to go and apply for a for the permit from the governor to get income taxes also exempted. There's in the end of that bill an electronic commerce type of adjustments where it gives 25% investment credit for the enterprise zones that qualify for that. The last thing I want to say about this bill before we get to the amendments is with the revenue impact that we are looking at as a result of the bill. In the most simplified numbers, we're looking at about $880,000 a year of negative impact to local governments starting in fiscal year 2005. Having said that, we need to qualify some of these statements. The revenue impacts from the bill, they could be either positive or negative, depending on which one is in operation. The first one, the Rural SIP, Strategic Investment Program, in essence, could be an investment inducer to start businesses and actually hire people and produce, and those employees will contribute to the income tax stream of the state. However, at this time, thinking that those investments mostly would be open for the semiconductor industry with the overcapacity that is plaguing the industry at this time from one side, and then having the long-term enterprise zone on the other side, I suspect that this program will not probably be immediately utilized. If at least one business is using this program or will use this program in the coming few years, we will have an impact of about $645,000 of a positive increase of local taxes. The allowance of the central assessed properties or utilities to qualify for either the SIP or the long-term enterprise will attract these utilities to be in the enterprise zones. Those utilities are probably would have built in these locations at any rate. Impact to local governments is about $350,000 a year starting 2005. The waiver of the 10% increase in employment versus 10% increase in productivity, it will allows, you know, these companies in the past, if they did not meet the 10% increase in employment, they would have come back to the tax rolls and start paying property taxes again. But because of that opening of the conditions to the 10% increase in productivity, it will give them a chance to reapply or re-qualify, and that will come up to about $400,000, preventing them from coming back to the tax rolls starting fiscal year 2004. The allowing of companies to qualify on year-by-year basis rather than having to qualify at the beginning, this will also add to preventing some properties from coming back on the rolls to the tune of about $130,000 per year. Finally, the investment threshold in the remote areas does not seem to generate enough interest at this time, but assuming that it does, somewhere around the 2006 and later, we'd be looking at a very strong and positive employment growth, about 20 to 40 in more jobs by the end of the third year. This is a significant job increase in these areas, and will generate a true, comparing to the size, a true economic boost for these counties. And in front of you, Mr. Chair, there's three amendments that we have copies of at this time.
We're going to hold off on the amendments until after the department has had a chance to introduce the bill, and then we'll go through each of the amendments. Mr. Jordan.
Chair Deckert, members of the committee, my name is Mike Burton. I'm the Assistant Director of the Economic and Community Development Department, and I was going to do some background on how we got here. I'm going to do a little bit of that, but I think you've heard a lot of it from staff. I would like to first touch briefly on, I'll explain the bill and how we got that far. This is a bill sponsored by the department. It's essentially an improved version of a bill that was introduced by the department in the last session that was responsive to a budget note that said figure out how to make this program work better, more efficiently and effectively. And it was our interpretation that that was really related to the people who have to do the work, the assessors and the zone sponsors. So we set about, after consulting, but perhaps not in enough detail with our the partners who deliver the program, we set about simplifying the program. And in that process, apparently, or ultimately, we found we had introduced fairly substantive changes in the bill that had fairly significant taxing impacts. Taxing jurisdictions were not pleased with that. That, along with other issues that arose and are arising again now, led the department to withdraw the bill from consideration in the last session and spend the interim with those partners, the cities, counties, ports, assessors, business representatives, union representatives, rewriting the proposal, which is had been through the House and in its modified version is in front of you now. The intention of the department going into this was twofold. One, to reorder the statute to make it usable, to structure it so that it starts with the creation of an enterprise zone in the beginning, works through the operation of an enterprise zone, the exemption itself, and ends with the termination of a zone. Right now, the statute has been built over time, and as pieces of improvements have been thought of and inserted, it's become a hodgepodge that is in no meaningful order. So you have to read through this very extensive dry material to try to find the pieces that are relevant to you. The department's second agenda coming into this was related to a sunset and the long-term rural enterprise zone exemption. But that component, that incentive program, is due to sunset in 2004 without an action by the legislature to extend that sunset. With those two items on our agenda,
Exactly what sunsets? The rural enterprise zone statute sunsets?
Chair Deckert, Senator Ringo, the long-term rural enterprise zone component of the enterprise zone program sunsets in 2004.
Thank you.
Unless the bill is adopted. So with that agenda, as I said, we brought together our partners and built the bill, which in the process incorporated some substantive changes. Some of those were meant to be improvements. Some of them dealt with issues that those among our partners were responsive or were dealing with. We felt like we came up with legislation that got us to where we wanted to go and would bring a whole room full of people to testify on behalf of the bill, which clearly we've done.
Mike, do you have a list of the people that you consulted with, or did you have a work group, or was it kind of ad hoc consultation with different Is that in the packet that you provided?
Chair Deckard, it is not. However, I can get you that list. I can get you the list of people who came to the meetings, but it was representatives, cities, counties, boards, businesses, unions. We tried to be as inclusive, the assessors, I can't leave them up, the Department of Revenue, ultimately. I can get you lists. It wasn't necessarily the same people each time, and some people came and went, but we felt like we had the base covered.
Put the word out. If you're interested in the program, come to these meetings. And
we continued to invite people who didn't come, feeling they were important. So we got a nucleus of partners who attended on a regular basis, and then some others who we still informed whether they came or not. We sent out reports of the meetings and felt like we had built a consensus. And I believe that almost everybody in this room, I'm not sure that anybody would object to this. I believe that we have a good bill here, with the exception of a couple points of contention. I think everybody here would say this needs to go forward. This is good legislation. You need to do this, and I'm certainly here to support it in that regard. So we put together a bill. It went through some changes in the House, and until very recently, we felt like we'd maintained our consensus and had something that would pass with a minimum of controversy. Given that, I'm going to talk briefly about the two primary programs that are contained in this bill, the Strategic Investment Program and the Rural and the Enterprise Zone Program, just to give you a picture of how they work. I'll try to do this quickly. The Strategic Investment Program is available statewide. Anywhere there's a project that would pay taxes on over $100 million, the program is applicable. The reality is that only happens in the Portland metro area. So as I get into this, I'll point out that we've scaled this to rural areas to try to provide broader applicability so that the incentive can be applied throughout the state. It incorporates up to 15 years of property tax exemption. The law says 7 to 15 years. The exemption starts, I said $100 million threshold. The reality is the first $100 million is taxed normally. Above that, there is a community service fee, which is 25% of the avoided taxes, up to currently a cap of $2 million. Additionally, there is a negotiated, doesn't have a name, there is an ability to cut additional agreements that could mandate, for instance, if there's an inordinate impact on the fire district, which is a place where we often hear concerns about this, they've got to get a new truck to get on top of the big buildings that come with these things. You could cut an agreement for the fire district or a school district to receive additional payments over and above that $100 million taxable base, the $2 million community service fee, and then the other piece. The important part of this is The intention of this was related to the big semiconductor fabs, but huge capital investment, $1 billion-plus investments, that were strictly penalized under the heavy bias that was present 10 years ago in the taxation system on property taxes. The investment generated taxes under the old law that was disproportionate to the burden that these facilities placed on their communities. $1 billion pays a lot of taxes. So, and doesn't get that level of investment. So a number of companies were saying, we aren't going to do this anymore. The system doesn't work, and if we can't fix this, we're going to leave Oregon. And you have representatives from Intel who would be here to speak to that if it would suit the committee. But it specifically was developed around them. This is a negotiated process. The state, through the department, needs to approve this, and so does the local jurisdictions that are impacted, the city, the county, if there's a tribe. There's a two-level approval process here. Additionally, there may be an income tax exemption. If there is, that needs to be approved by the governor. So there are several levels of approval in this very negotiated process. There is a requisite first source hiring agreement. I think I've already covered most of the rest of this.
So what basically is the definition of that first course hiring agreement?
The premise in both of these programs, Strategic Investment Program and Rural, and the Enterprise Zone Program, is that any firm that's going to benefit from these programs has to commit to making the jobs available to local folks. They have to approach a local service provider with their recruitment notices. Typically, that's become the employment department, although it doesn't have to be. The law isn't as narrowly subscribed as that. But
so if I'm building a facility in Lincoln City, I have to, upon building, have to put out notice to the...
Not upon building. The agreement currently does not apply to construction jobs. It applies to employment at the firm that's receiving the benefit.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
Do either of these programs have any clawback provisions?
Senator Corcoran, or Chair Deckard, Senator Corcoran, both of them have provisions that if the agreement is violated, there are repayment requirements, and there may be penalties depending on the nature of the breach of contract, essentially. Okay, moving on to enterprise zones. Enterprise zones are much older. They were created roughly 10 years before the Strategic Investment Program in 1985. There are 47 enterprise zones allowed under law, plus two tribal enterprise zones, plus the potential for federal enterprise communities to be designated. There are actually three classes of federal incentive programs, one of which exists in Oregon, which is Josephine County outside of Grants Pass. So there are currently 49 enterprise zones, the 47 authorized, plus one tribal, plus Josephine County. The enterprise zones are a property tax exemption, a qualifying business, which is primarily manufacturing or wholesale distribution, can, by virtue of applying, receive 3 years of property tax exemptions. There is a potential for a fourth or fifth year for businesses that pay well, 150% of county average wage. Those fourth and or fifth year are negotiated, so the zone sponsors, which are cities, counties, and or tribes, will come to the table and cut a deal for the fourth and fifth years if there is to be a fourth and fifth year. There are limitations, geographic limitations on enterprise zones, no more than 12 square miles. There are limits on how far between the pieces of a zone you can have a zone made up of segments. There are limitations on how far apart those can be. There are limitations on how far from one side of a zone to the other side of the zone. So essentially, the legislature was looking to create an incentive that applied to distressed communities and gave them a competitive advantage in terms of siting businesses. Again, responsive to the heavy burden in Oregon on property taxes. These are awarded on a competitive basis. The last time we had a round, we had four zones available, and we had eight applicants, so not everybody got a zone. And that's important when we get to the allocation of work in the bill, because we're people who raise their hand and say, I want one, are being offered an opportunity to do more of the work under the bill to get at that complaint that a disproportionate of a workload was falling on assessors who don't volunteer to get a zone. The department has a fairly limited role in enterprise zones. We hold the annual competition. We select the zones that are designated based on criteria that we publish when we do the competition, and we provide technical assistance. We don't approve anything related to the zones once the zone's designated.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Inga.
The annual competition, is that for additional enterprise zones that they kind of recertify existing ones?
Chair Deckard, Senator Ringo, each enterprise zone has a 10-year life. At the end of 10 years, the zone becomes available. In 2004, for instance, there are two new or two old enterprise zones that will reach the end of their term. At that point, and not until then, because we don't have any additional zones right now, we'll do a competition for those two zones. There was a bill that would have created five more zones. If that were to happen, we would have sponsored a competition for those five zones.
And you have a chart here. It says 82 cities sponsor enterprise zones. I thought you gave a small...
Chair Deckard, Senator Ringo, in many cases there are multiple sponsors. Anytime the zone includes property within a city or in a county, those entities have to be sponsored. So the 49 current zones include 82 sponsors, which are a mix of cities, counties, and one tribe. I've talked about the 3 to 5 year exemption. I think I'll just move on to the long-term rural exemption, which is a fairly new product. It was created by the 99 legislature, and at the time was referred to us at least as the new core bill. But it was very specifically tailored to a specific large project that was going to be in rural Oregon. So it created a new kind of enterprise zone, which includes actually, this is the one that has the income tax exemption in it, not strategic investment. I'm sorry, got those confused. But it has the potential to be a 15-year exemption. It has all property taxes, so all property taxes are exempted during that period. It has the potential for income tax exemption, and it must be in a county with distress factors that are extreme. The distress factors are applied to the county. They're related to per capita income and unemployment. But for those counties that are extreme in that regard, the long-term rural investment program is an incentive.
Have we had any successes?
We've had one. Roseburg Lumber qualified. Getting back to the history, it was so specifically tailored at coming out of the 99 session that it really didn't apply to anybody but Nucor. Significant work went into the program during the 2001 session and essentially created, in our opinion, a tailored strategic investment program, which might be why I get them confused. I'm not sure. But at that time, we felt like we'd created a workable program, something depending on the size of the community, how far it was from Interstate 5, for instance, number of other factors, the threshold for qualification became a moving target, and maybe as low as $12.5 million investment in very remote small communities. The problem with the program, and the reason we're asking for the sunset, is that in 2001 we were on the verge of a great recession, and businesses have not been making investments of any magnitude in rural Oregon. So we believe that this is a workable program. We think it has potential. We think it's going to need to see the economy cycle back up before anybody steps up, anybody else. There has been one project. So given that, I thought what I'd do is walk through, I'll explain what I've got in this document. I've been reading from pages 3, 4, 5, and 6, which are sort of a description of the Enterprise Zone and Strategic Investment Programs. In the beginning, I have the balance of the testimony I expect to actively cover today, which is to hit on the high points of the bill, the significant points. It's a large bill, but most of it is just reshuffling the deck, existing statute, in order to get to a more ordered sequence. Moving along, on page 7, there is a history of the Enterprise Zone program, and then from 8 and 9, I'm referring to large numbers handwritten in the corner, since each of these sections was otherwise numbered individually. There is a description or a comparison of the attributes of each of the programs. Perhaps one of the most interesting sections, but one which I don't have time to go through, starts on page 11, but it's an analysis of the activity in enterprise zones over the last tax year. I'd be happy to meet outside of this with anybody and go over any of these pieces or answer questions on any of it. But to go through this would consume a lot of time. Page 32 is a list of the zones that have been created and then years in which they were terminated. And starting on page 33 is a section-by-section analysis of the legislation. And if it would be helpful, I can walk through this. But I'm not planning on doing it right now.
Can you hit the high points in committee if we have questions? But you can hit the ones that really...
Right.
Stick out.
That's my intention. Then back in the back, 43, 45, there's more detailed information. 45 is significant because there was passed in the last session authority to create 4 electronic commerce enterprise zones, and that's a very specialized component of this. We had proposed in the bill that that number might be changed. The House chose not to do that. The House moved it forward with no changes in the number of e-commerce zones. So under law, there are 4 e-commerce zones allowed.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Steyer.
Did you propose to increase that number or decrease?
Chair Deckert, Senator Steyer, we were open to possibilities, and we're assuming that there might be an interest in increasing the number.
Yeah, okay.
We had, I believe, 13 applications for 4 zones, so it appeared to us there was plenty of market for the concept, but the House chose to focus the incentive and chose not to increase the number.
So that program has really worked well in Southern Oregon, but we've only had it for, what, 8 or 9 months?
Yeah. There was, and Chair Deckert, there was a flaw in the program, a matter of timing. The program was created as a standalone and then kind of morphed into the Enterprise Zone program, and it created a conflict with a couple of key dates so that it made it very difficult for firms to actually qualify. You've addressed that, and we expect to see significantly more activity. But Southern Oregon is the place where it's been happening. I'll now go back to page 1 and walk through the significant points in the bill. The first section of the bill relates to the strategic investment program. As we've already mentioned, it creates a scaled version for rural areas. Instead of the $100 million currently available statewide, it would tax the first $25 million at the appropriate rate, whatever that is, create a scaled community service fee of $500,000, and still allow for any other agreement component of the major program. We consider this to be a major policy change. A piece that came with that is a negotiation with the special districts, which previously were not involved in the negotiations on the distribution of the community service fee. In the past, the cities and counties have made the decisions on how the fee gets distributed. For this rural component, the special districts will be invited to a discussion of how it gets distributed. They won't be party to the discussions with the company that determines what the fee is and any other agreements. We didn't want to complicate the negotiations from the company's perspective, but there will be a community service fee. It will be distributed, and the special districts will be at the table to decide how that gets done under the bill. A significant change that was related to a concern that surfaced and one of the major contributors to the department's decision to withdraw the bill last time is we've proposed that electrical generation facilities be incorporated into the strategic investment program. Under current law, they are specifically exempted. Our thought is that this is a negotiated program. The long-term rural exemption is a negotiated program. If we can get them to a negotiated program, then issues related to workforce and construction labor could be addressed in the negotiations process. The local cities, counties would be at the table and talking to them about, if you want the exemption, here's what you're going to have to do to get it. And if there was an interest in creating a precedent or a preference subject to U.S. constitutional law, this would be a place where we thought it could be addressed. And we felt like this legislation took care of the issue that surfaced in the last session.
So, okay. Senator Ringa.
So why was it specifically excluded in the previous?
Chair Deckard, Senator Ringer, I don't know. I don't have that much history. I don't know why it was excluded last time around. I think, as we discussed related to the Klamath Falls issue, I think the environment has changed, and these are large investments, but they all used to be built by the local utility and provided services to the local consumers of electricity, so it wasn't important for them to get the tax exemption. Now it's a different issue, and that's one of the issues that will be coming to you in the context of an amendment today. But
so
it was our intention.
What is the rationale? I mean, I'm just trying to think through. I guess it's the flip side of that question. Why do we need to incent centrally assessed utilities to locate in some of these areas? Wouldn't they just normally do it anyhow because there's a market for it?
Chair Deckard, I think the situation has changed, and I think to a large degree there are only limited opportunities for where those would be. Those opportunities aren't all in Oregon. The circumstances that arise in northeastern Oregon, specifically Umatilla and Morrow counties, which have led to a proliferation of these facilities there, most of them are fueled now by gas. So gas pipelines, electrical transmission facilities and cooling water are the three that, that sort of come together and determine where these happen. Are present there. They're present in Klamath County, which is why there are at least a couple projects being considered there. There's a site in Turner that's appropriate for this, but they're not present everywhere. So that would lead to the conclusion you're drawing. On the other hand, many of the same circumstances exist on the Washington side of the Columbia in opposite northeastern Oregon. So there's a thought that there might be merit in incenting those developments in Oregon so that, that we're a producer of energy and not strictly an importer.
Does Washington have similar incentive programs for central assessed utilities?
My understanding is that they're an active one, if they haven't already. But it's been in process.
If they did last session, it would be, you know, they just adjourned. It would be interesting to see exactly what they may have. Senorita.
Could we make an agreement with Washington just not to do this? I'm kidding.
Okay. Chair Deckard, members of the committee, I'm moving along. I'll talk next about the Enterprise Zone program. Maybe I should pause and ask if there are any other questions related to strategic investment at this point, since I'm leaving that in terms of my presentation.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ringo.
I had a question. I've often heard the strategic investment programs analyzed and defended with respect to the chip manufacturing facilities, because those are so capital intensive, and that really puts them... It sets them apart from a normal manufacturing facility. I mean, a normal manufacturing facility is expensive, but it's not $2 billion. And I'm just wondering whether how does that analysis fit into reducing the amount and allowing it in rural areas?
Chair Deckard, Senator Ringo, I'm not sure I understand your question, but I'll give it a try. And if I'm not on track, we can try it again. But the question might be, how applicable is this, and what's the validity of $5 million in terms of rural areas? I was asked that question in the House and attempted to get information on... I selected Marion County, Lane County, and Clackamas County to see how many facilities there were that were over $25 million in terms of assessed valuation. And I looked at Clackamas County because Representative Hunt was asking the question. The only place I got data back from was Marion County, and I found that there were 8 taxpayers in Marion County who are paying taxes on facilities worth $25 million or more. Those included the phone company, the power company, and the gas company, and those are centrally assessed facilities, and it's not an individual facility but a network in that case. So discounting those, you'd be talking 5 facilities have been built in Marion County that would be potentially eligible for this level of investment. You know, it's not something that's going to happen every day. It's still a high enough threshold so that we don't see it as a huge giveaway or gift, and it is a negotiated process. So that if there was a run on electrical generating facilities in Umatilla County, which has been the case, if they reached the point where they didn't want to incent them anymore, they could just say, no more deals. We're not going to do it. You're going to pay full boat from now on. So, we would like to keep that in mind as we go forward with this concept. Is that responsive?
Well, one of the things you said earlier was that because we are a property tax-based state, largely property income tax, that therefore these facilities pay a disproportionate tax, a tax disproportionate to their burden. And perhaps the burden is considered based on the number of employees they have, for example, how many folks are on the road and how much utility service they use. But I think that burden is particularly high for the high-tech facilities as a percentage of their capital investment, because their capital investment is so huge. And so I'm just wondering whether there's something... Is that burden disproportionately high for if we're talking about a facility that's not a chip plant?
Okay.
So I guess that's what I'm trying to focus on, is that we're giving a break because of the disproportionate burden placed on these facilities.
Chair Deckard, Senator Ringo. you get into more facilities when you drop the threshold to $25 million. I didn't bring the list, and I can't remember all of them, but among the ones that I do remember were Pittsburgh Paint and Glass, which has built a $30 million plant out on the airport industrial park, which is more of a typical industrial facility than the chip manufacturers or the energy generating facilities. The energy generating facilities, I would say, are very similar to the chip plants, and that for the investment, there's very little employment. There is a lot of water consumption, but they pay for that. They buy water. So I think they're consistent. Yep, another one here is Mitsubishi, or now Sumco, which is another high-tech wafer manufacturer. So there aren't very many who aren't in that category. So I'm not sure that we can really get to a meaningful analysis of that.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other strategic investment program questions? We can always come back to it when they occur to you. Okay. Moving along, the Enterprise Zone program. A provision that we've introduced in the bill was related to a Lincoln County issue. It's one that led to the legislation that, or I tried to address the factor that led to the legislation suggesting five more zones. But the issue in Lincoln County was that Lincoln City doesn't want to incent hotels and destination resorts because they feel they have plenty. The existing zone in Lincoln County does incent those, and the current law requires that's a local option, but the option must be uniform across an enterprise zone. We're proposing that it wouldn't have to be uniform across the zone. It would have to be uniform within a given jurisdiction. So Lincoln City could make its choice and would have to live with its choice, but the choice wouldn't have to be the same as Newport or Siletz. So that's a fairly minor, we think, change, but it's in the bill. There's one that's just related to terminology. We have a pre-certification now. There's no certification, so everybody wants to know when's the certification, and we're changing it to an application. There's been an issue about – there are questions – I'll just skip over the minor ones if that's okay, because I'm running long here. There's one that Senator Ringo was getting at with staff, and that's related to an investment meant to increase productivity. This is a proposal that's coming to us from Portland Development Commission because they're seeing businesses that are interested in making investments that would increase the tax base, that would increase their connection to the community because they've got new investment there, but they're doing it to remain competitive in a global economy. They're doing it to make their workers more productive. So they're proposing that we still incent that kind of investment, and it's an enterprise zone exemption, so it's a property tax exemption related to an investment in real property. So it's very much an investment-driven exemption. But it's not about creating jobs. It's about keeping the businesses that we have. And so that's where that's coming from. I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, it does. I mean, just as a comment, it seems like it's really difficult for PDC to know if allowing the exemption is going to create the incentive for, say, it's a modernization, or whether it would happen anyway. To me, it's a...
Chair Deckard, Senator Ringo, there is actually in Section 33 a description of the criteria to be used, the evaluation process for measuring that increase in productivity is based on looking back at the prior year and then documenting that there's been an increase.
Yeah, but I guess, I mean, these companies are always under pressure to modernize, and perhaps they're going to be doing that anyway.
That Chair Deckard, Senator Ringo, that's the question I get asked most of the time about this program. How do you really know? And you don't always really know that it wouldn't have happened anyway, but there have been some cases where I know for sure that it made a difference. And one of those, I got into this when I worked in Central Oregon, and Redmond had an enterprise zone and Bend didn't. A lot of people would come to Central Oregon to vacation in Bend, and they'd get interested, and they'd want to locate their plant in Bend, and found out that at the time there was only 200 acres of industrial land, and the largest tract was 4 acres. But 13 miles away, there was Redmond with an enterprise zone and 2,500 acres. Now, there's two factors there, and both of them were important, but people always ask the question about enterprise zones. Precision Cast Parts did an expansion some years ago in the Tri-Cities area, but told us that if there was an enterprise zone near their Milwaukee plant, that they would do it there. They came back to us for their next expansion and said, if there's an enterprise zone here, we'll do it in Milwaukee. We designated an enterprise zone in Milwaukee, and Precision Cast Parts did their next expansion at their current plant. So there are cases where it works. I believe this is an incentive that is effective and really works. In my mind, the three-year enterprise zone exemption is a no-brainer. You give up taxes for 3 years, and you get somebody who's paying taxes as long as the building's still standing there. That's I'll do that as often as you'll let me, as long as I get to keep the money. I'll do it over and over again. So I think this is a very effective program. What we're talking about here are fixes to make it more effective. One of the major issues, getting back to enterprise zone, and one of the reasons a lot of these people are here today is because we have asked for treatment of centrally assessed properties within an enterprise zone the same as any other business in an enterprise zone. That's a fairly substantive issue, and we think prospectively it's a good one to put in the enterprise zone bill. Where we've created conflict is for deals that have been made already, the deals done, the buildings, the facilities under construction are ready to go into production, and we're changing the rules that were the basis for that deal. And there are people behind me who are waiting to talk to you about that, so I'm not going to spend any more time on it. But that is a major piece here. There's a moderate piece that staff addressed, which is related to, came up in the House, but there was a case of a firm in Albany that, and this is not a unique case, it just was the driver for an amendment that Representative Close sponsored, but the company expanded with every intention of creating additional jobs. They're a titanium cast company. Their market went down. They have every expectation that the markets will turn around in the future. But under the current law, if you don't make it the first year, you don't get it. You've got expanding businesses have to increase their employment under the current law. And if they don't, they lose out. If they qualify for the first year and things turn down in the second or third year, they could lose the exemption for that year, but they don't lose it for good. They can always come back later on and requalify for the 3 year window or the 5 year window doesn't move. So they've lost a year that they won't get back, but it doesn't eliminate year three if they lost year two. So this amendment would apply the same rationale to year one. The company moves forward with good faith effort. They make their investment. They don't make their employment target, so they pay their taxes. But if they meet their employment target in the future, they can come back and qualify in the future. So that's what this amendment's about. The last major piece is a long-term rural enterprise zone, and it's moving that sunset that I talked about. There is a minor piece that came up that we've introduced into that, which is that this is the only place where anything ever comes off the tax rolls. And none of these programs, because they're all about new investment, nothing comes off the tax rolls. We just exempt taxes on new investment, except in long-term rural, where the way the law was written, land and other existing property comes off the tax rolls. We're suggesting that be treated like anywhere else, and nobody loses any revenues when an enterprise zone or strategic investment program investment happens. They will instead forego an increase in revenue. So that's what that piece is about. That's a quick and dirty run through. It took me 2 days in the House. But I'd be happy to answer questions, or I can get out of the way and you can talk to other folks. And I'm going to stay so you can bring me back up here if you want to.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the concise and excellent and abbreviated for our short attention span in the Senate. Questions for Mr. Burton?
I just want to, Mr. Chair, thank you for the pre-work, too, and meet. I don't know if you met with other legislators, but you did meet with me, and so that's helpful as well.
Thank you. So let's bring up, we're going to do the Umatilla Amendment first. We have a number who've come a great distance, Mr. Mather, Mr. Sweek, Mr. Grace. And Ms. Deister. And Gail.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Michelle Deister with the League of Oregon Cities, injecting myself into the testimony of some friends that I brought along with me today. With me here is Greg Sweek, who is the Enterprise Zone Manager and Assessor for Morrow County. Ray Grace, who is a commissioner from Morrow County, and Rex Mather, who is the city manager of Boardman. They're here today to talk to you about some unintended consequences surrounding Section 34C, which is the construction in progress exemption that was alluded to by Mike, Mr. Burton. So with that, I think I'll turn it over to Greg.
Good afternoon, Chair Deckert and members of the committee. My name is Greg Sweek. I'm the Morrow County Assessor, and I'm also the Enterprise Zone Manager for the Columbia River Enterprise Zone. And what brings us here to the table is basically two issues. The first issue Mike alluded to is we have a plant in our area who we negotiated along a five-year Enterprise Zone agreement with the understanding that before it was eligible to go in and take advantage of the Enterprise Zone being operational, it would be taxable. This changes those ground rules the way the bill is written now. Section 34 C, D, and E would allow them to be exempt for this year except for paying to local districts. That means that the city and the county and the schools lose out on that money. And it doesn't kick into the Enterprise Zone five-year exemption where the city has negotiated a deal to get upfront payments during that five-year period to help them with their water and their sewer bill issues that they have. Our second concern has to do with centrally assessed properties and giving them the construction in progress exemption. We think that deserves being looked at, but that's a large issue. You have rate-regulated and non-rate-regulated plants that get involved in there. And so we think that that should be looked at in the interim. There has been a dramatic change in the power industry, and nobody would deny that. I think it deserves to have a good look at it, but I think the interim is the time to bring together the players on that and look at it comprehensively rather than in a isolated part of the what's a reorganization bill, basically, for enterprise zone statutes. Thank you. If you look at the last page of my testimony, you'll see this is the impact that the Avista plant has in Morrow County from the 2002 tax year based on $143 million value. You'll see that they have a $2.7 million tax bill. Of that, $700,000 goes to support schools, so that's an issue at the state level that would be backfilled. And then the $1.4 million is local government operations. Of that, almost a little over $1 million is the city and the county's portion that would, the way the bill is written currently, would not be collected, which would be a severe hardship for both of those entities.
Thank you very much.
Chair Eckert, members of the committee, my name is Rex Mather. I'm the city manager of the city of Boardman. In February of 2000, we executed an agreement extending the tax exemption for 2 years. At that time, the agreement was executed with Enron, but due to changes of ownership, it's now Avista Morant. And our agreement with them states that beginning in the first year, after the project construction has been completed, this project is not under construction. We did the final on that in November of 2002. So this there's no construction going on here. They've had some really unfortunate circumstances with equipment failure in that, and that is indeed unfortunate. However, due to our agreement, we have budgeted for our in lieu of tax payments for this year. It won't put us out of business, but it with the $138,000 is a fair amount of money in a budget of a city the size of Boardman. The 34C, which would exempt, we would get nothing out of that, and we have lost sale of water also during that time. The city of Boardman supports Morrow County's position as far as providing the exemption to the work in construction, work in progress exemption by those centrally assessed facilities. Thank you very much for your attention.
So my reading is correctly that it's 35% or approximately 35% of the city of Boardman's budget would be tied up in this amendment?
If we lose all property, that just 35% of our budget or 35% of our tax base is the Vista plant.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Michelle Deister, I think what you're seeing here is an example of communities that have been inadvertently caught in the middle of this particular section of the bill. And since this situation came to light in Morrow County, I think a larger debate has really taken place within our membership about construction and progress exemptions in general. And we're here to tell you today that we feel pretty strongly that construction and progress exemption Section 34C should be removed from the bill. It's a major shift in tax policy to allow this exemption, and as Mr. Sweek alluded, perhaps this might better be debated separately so that we can take another look at the revenue impacts, et cetera. And so to that end, we present the B-12 amendments for your consideration.
Thank you. Did you want to testify, sir?
Chair Deckert, members of the committee, I'm Ray Grace, Morrow County Commissioner, and I came to lend the court support to Mr. Sweek, who has the numbers and the expertise in this. So I'm here to back him. Thank you.
Senator Farriola.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I at one point in time had the honor, the distinct honor of representing Morrow County. I do not currently have that honor, but I am very interested in this issue. And I understand that there's been an attempt to come to some accommodation between the taxing jurisdictions and the Avista Company. And I understand those discussions need to proceed forward from this point to a successful conclusion. I just wondered if anybody would care to talk about the hopes that the community has in resolving an issue like this one.
Chair Deckert, Senator Farriola, I will, Ray Grace, I'll address the issue that, to the point that Morrow County Court has in the last several weeks made a good faith effort to meet with the principals of the Avista plant ownership and to make a good faith deal. We have been unable to get everyone to the table, and we can't make a deal without players.
Mr. Chairman, I know that there are other amendments to this bill, some that may be, in fact, a little controversial, possibly. And I don't know how much time that the committee intends to invest in this bill. I see from the witness list we have 4 or 5 days worth of testimony here to take, although I don't think we'll be here engaged in that bill that long. But I would like to just ask the chairman's indulgence to encourage all the parties in this issue to engage. And perhaps it would be to everybody's best interest, while other issues are being considered in this bill, to have discussions, and maybe even at the chair's discretion, the appointment of a working group composed of the management of the Avista project and its partners and the community of Morrow and the community of Boardman to work together to see about coming to an accommodation, if that's possible. I'd have another question for Mr. Steister. This seems to be under the rubric of no good deed ever goes unpunished. Here we are trying to make a good incentive bill a little broaden its implications and apply it to rural communities, and yet we seem to have wrapped ourselves around the axle on this thing, at least in one case in Morrow County. Do you know of any others?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I do believe that Umatilla County may very well have an issue with this bill, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, he's nodding back there. So, but those are the only two that I am currently aware of at this time. Again, I think, as was alluded to earlier, there could possibly be some issues in Klamath County, but they haven't been brought to my attention up to this point. So,
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I guess the I think the committee needs to hear from all the parties in this issue. My mother used to tell me there's no pancake so thin it doesn't have two sides. So I'd be interested in hearing all I can about this issue and making sure that the parties all are trying to reach out to each other in good faith. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mazin.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ferrioli, also at that time we had discussions in the House that Columbia County had a problem with this language, and that's why the urban renewal district language was added in, because they had an urban renewal and enterprise zone on top of each other kind of thing. And
Sort of condominiumized it. It's a density factor problem.
Thank you very much for coming. We appreciate the time it took to get here. Mr. Chalmers, did you want to add anything? Or if there's anyone else, proponents of these amendments, now would be a good time to come up if you're on the list.
Chair Deckert, members of the committee, my name is Paul Chalmers. I'm the assessor for Umatilla County. I've also been asked to speak on behalf of our Board of County Commissioners. I got involved in this discussion approximately 3 weeks ago when I was asked to participate in a conference call with the players that we're talking about with the Vista, Morrill County, Port, City of Boardman, and such. This would have impacted Umatilla County dramatically in the expansion of Calpine, which is a cogen facility located in our facility in our county. Would impacted Umatilla County to the extent of $3.7 million of tax revenue during the construction phase, of which a little over $2 million would have been associated to schools at 55% of that value. I've been involved in assessment taxation for approximately 13 years. I have yet to participate in interim committees or legislative process where companies come and say, we feel we pay too little. Haven't seen it happen. That's part of the dilemma we're dealing with right now, where we have exempted properties, special assessments, to the extent where that burden has shifted, and especially in today's environment where we're dealing with a permanent rate environment, anytime you lose value, you lose revenue to the local resources. Umatilla County, and again, I'm speaking on behalf of our Board of County Commissioners, are completely against 34C. And would agree with the comments of Mr. Sweet that we feel that this should be looked at in an interim time frame and outside this piece of legislation trying to clean up the enterprise zone and strategic investment. So from Umatilla County, the message I bring to you is let's remove 34C and continue our discussion.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your time. And
my pleasure.
Mr. Anderson, Mr. Carlberg, Mr. Hefty,
incredibly,
and Mr. Vincent, do you want to come up also? That's the other side of this issue. Afternoon.
The other side.
Yeah, okay. The other side. Yeah. Good point.
Mr. Chair, Jim Anderson with the Vista Corporation. Today, here with Mr. Tim Carlberg, who is projects manager for Vista Corporation, and Mr. Chris Hefty, tax manager with the Vista. I think Mr. Vincent is here from a Vista Corporation also. He may have an opinion or two on another issue that's before you concerning this same bill. The two major issues that we have with the bill and have had through its inception are construction work in progress, Section 34 on page 26 of the bill, and the tax issue in Morrill County, which is encapsulated in 34 D and E. The one thing I would be very quick to remind the committee is that Oregon is and has been for years an energy importer, a net energy importer of all energy sources. The relating clause on this bill states business development tax incentives. I think it's a very good vehicle for construction work in progress issues. This issue has been in this bill through its concept, through its inception at the department. It's not a late arrival to the bill. And we think the forum that we have before us and had over in the House Revenue Committee is a very good forum to debate this issue. And to delay it to the interim would just be simply delaying the inception and implementation of an issue like this. It's been long in coming. I had history with PacifiCorps for 32 years. And of that 32 years, I can remember this issue coming up every year as a disincentive to locate energy facilities in this state. And it still is. And if it's our belief as a state that we want to be self-reliant for no other reason on our own energy sources rather than depending on another state and in some cases another nation such as Canada to import energy products to this state and pay their price, then so be it. But if it's truly your belief to make Oregon energy independent, to set our own prices here in a now deregulated market, then now's the time to do it. That's energy. That's the construction work in progress as we see it. The other issue with Morrow County, with the city of Boardman, Mr. Carlberg and Mr. Hefty would like to address those, and then we would take your questions.
Chair Deckert, committee members, my name is Tim Carlberg with Avista Corporation. I am the project manager for the Coyote Springs project. And we have had some hard times during this project. And I thought I would just go through a bit of a timeline briefly so that you would understand how we got to the point we're at right now. The project started construction January 1st of 2001, and everything was going along fine. December of 2001, Enron went bankrupt. And when Enron went bankrupt, the company that was our EPC contractor began having troubles. That was NEPCO. And our contractor on site, EPIC, was also a subsidiary of Enron, and eventually in April of 2002, they were removed from the site. But that wasn't the major issue. The transformer that we're talking about that has caused the problem was energized on March 3rd of 2002. And this transformer is the component that gets the energy that's produced from the generators into the transmission system. And without this transformer, we're unable to operate the plant. March 3rd of 2002, the transformer was energized. May 6th of 2002, the transformer failed. It had an internal failure, blew up, had a fire, spilled some oil. We cleaned it up. We worked with the EQ very closely, Oregon DEQ. They were satisfied and are satisfied at this time. On June 13th of 2002, we entered into an agreement with Alstom, the company that we had purchased the first transformer from, and we agreed that we would buy from them a second transformer. Now, you're wondering, why would we do that? Well, we needed to try to get this plant online as quickly as possible, and the only company that could meet the quickest time frame schedule was Alstom. On June 13th, as I said, we entered into agreement for us to purchase another transformer. The last week of June, we went to Istanbul, Turkey to do a design review to make sure that the transformer was satisfactory from a design standpoint. We were satisfied with the design. We took experts with us, not only from our company, but from GE, from around the country. The manufacturing of the transformer had continued during this period of time. On August 30th of 2002, the transformer was being tested. The transformer failed test. It had another failure. I was there during the failure. When the transformer failed, we stuck around. Myself and the expert that was with me stuck around for another 11 days to investigate and determine what the cause of the failure was and to make sure that we could remedy any problems that had occurred during the construction. We felt comfortable, and on September 10th, 2002, we opted to leave Istanbul, Turkey, and come back to continental United States. Possibly you can understand that we didn't want to be traveling on September 11th, 1 year after the problem in New York City. The transformer was repaired in the factory. On November 4th and 5th, it was retested satisfactorily. We had agreed with Alstom that they would expedite the transportation back to the United States. They put this transformer, this one sole transformer, on a boat by itself, went into Houston on December 6th. It entered Houston. It came to Boardman, Oregon on December 12th. On December 18th, it was opened up because you can't enter into the transformer until everything was in place on the foundation. Take off your impact recorders. That would be the last point that a problem could occur. On December 18th, it was discovered there was a problem. December 20th, we had the people from Alstom on site, and they determined at that time that the transformer was not repairable on site. Something would have to be done. In the month of January, Alstom had submitted to us a schedule for getting a new for getting the transformer repaired here in the United States. On at the end of April, the transformer passed the test, and it was shipped to the Boardman, Oregon facility. And at this time, it appears that everything is going along fine, and we're going to energize this transformer actually tomorrow, if everything is going on schedule, and it was this morning. We will have the transformer, the project energized and commercially operational, if everything goes the way we feel, by July 1st. Now, the initial schedule for us to have the project online was June 1st of 2002. That was 17 months after the construction had started, but after Enron had defaulted on, after they had gone bankrupt and NEPCO had defaulted on the contract, things got extended out, and we figured that we would have had the project online, even with those situations, in August of 2002. But because of this other transfer failure situations, we were unable to do that. During the time that we've had the construction project going, we've utilized union labor. At one time, we had almost 400 union people in on the project doing work. We feel that in the future that we will have additional work. We will have additional work for people coming in to do various maintenance procedures that are not going to be able to be done by PGE, et cetera. So if the project would have been online as we had expected, we would not be looking at having this additional bill that was not budgeted for us for this upcoming tax year, 2003 to 2004. And I guess it should be kept in mind that when we do budgeting and we do look at siting a plant, we take everything into consideration. We are closely looked at, as you all know, by the PUC. We have to make prudent judgments and evaluations when we do site a plant and put it someplace, and we do have to do it at the least cost. And that is something that was taken into consideration when this plant was purchased from Enron at that time. I guess that pretty much is kind of a timeline and sets up some of the reasons why we got here right now. Are there any questions?
Questions? Senator Hannan.
Yes. Did Enron at any time negotiate with Morrow County as part of your partner, or were you, as Avista, the only one to do the negotiating?
Senator Deckert, Chair Deckert, Senator Hannan. Once we purchased, and I only came into the project of January of 2001, and prior to that, Avista Power, our non-regulated subsidiary, did have the dealings with Enron, and I never had the dealings with Enron, so I'm not exactly sure what if I can answer that question. But I never have dealt with Enron in regards to any negotiating any...
Does Avista Utility own all the Coyote project?
Avista Utility... Senator Deckert, Chair Deckert, Senator Hannan. Avista Utility owned 50% of the project. Merit Corporation out of Atlanta, Georgia, owns the other 50%.
Have they been in on the negotiations?
They have not during this last period of time. Unfortunately, the fellow that would be my counterpart had a death in the family and has been unavailable to really deal very heavily in some of these issues at this time.
So when Morrow County says that they were unable to negotiate, they were negotiating with you as the sole person but not the other partner. Is that the accurate assumption?
Chair Deckert, Senator Hannan, that is basic. We really never entered into any negotiations, I would have to say, because I was under the impression that the city of Boardman, Morrow County, and some of the other people that had attended a meeting about 2 weeks ago, must have been on May 16th or 17th, that another draft of an amendment to this bill would have been drafted, and then we would look to see what we could work out. But unfortunately, that might have still been difficult because of this other fellow's family situation.
I see. Okay. Thank you, Mr.
How have your negotiations so far gone with the city and county over this issue?
Senator Deckert, they have been somewhat, we've been trying to meet and try to get the merit folks and Avista folks and our tax people to understand the whole issue and see what direction we should go. So I guess we have been trading voicemails and have had very few conversations, and we have had one email from Greg Sweek, and that was about it. And the Memorial Day weekend did put a bit of a crimp in people getting together.
My interest would be, and I haven't pulled the committee, would be to adopt the amendments, be glad to relent from that if the city and county and Avista got together and post-haste and just negotiate this out and came to some sort of agreement. I understand that there is one to be had. So that would be my interest.
Chair Deckert, I guess so you would be asking me if we would be willing to do that. I believe we would be willing to do that. We would negotiate with the city and the county.
Great.
Thank you. Would you like to hear from Chris Hefty at this time?
Sure.
Okay. Chairman Deckert and members of the committee, my name is Chris Hefty. I'm the tax manager for Avista Corporation. I guess I've gotten involved because I guess in our case, having to explain an item that isn't budgeted the last couple of years, some additional property taxes, have got me having to do a lot of explanation. So, through the amendment the way it currently stands, one of our concerns has been in the state of Oregon, the fact that construction in progress is taxable to a centrally assessed operation, whereas non-centrally assessed, there is not subject to tax. So I think one of our primary reasons behind the legislation was that to put kind of even the playing field, and just from that perspective there. The other, I guess, from our own standpoint, our planning standpoint, is we look at the timelines, and when we look at where we're going to place plants, of course, the tax department has to take a look at it and kind of give a projection to what we think property taxes or transaction taxes, income taxes are going to be. And when we looked at this particular facility, it looked like the way the time frame was going to work is that we would have had it online, but there wouldn't have been any property taxes during the construction period. Then the 130, we were going to pay a fee of $138,000 a year for the first 5 years. And that's the way we budget. That's the way we're looking at it. Then we had the events here that have happened come along, and last year we ended up paying $2.7 million on just construction in progress on a plant that still hasn't generated any revenue. Unfortunately, we're a year later now, and we're probably looking at maybe a tax bill of $3 to $4 million more, with again no revenue coming in. So that's in terms of how the numbers are working right now there. So I guess the only other thing I just for my own just statements I'd like to make is just that we're looking at, this is a substantial investment we've made here, and it's something that there is a five-year exemption already, but then that plant's going to be there for many years to come. We're going to be involved in the community, and there's a lot of other property taxes. There'll be income taxes we pay, and any other transaction-type taxes that happen. So that's kind of the point I wanted to make, and I don't know if there's any questions.
Senator Farrion.
I'll defer to Senator Hannah.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I wanted to ask a question. The timing of bringing the facility online versus the timing of the tax when you say it's not budgeted. In other words, you were under the working assumption that the tax would not be levied until it was brought online. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. I think with the way the dates were going to work with Chairman Deckert, Senator Hannon. The way the dates were working, the assessment date in Oregon is 12/31. So at 12/31/2000, there was no investment there. We started construction early 2001, and if we had the plant online by April of the 2002, then our $138,000 fee would have applied. We came close there. I mean, it would have been the way things happened. It would look like it was probably going to be closer to June. So the 2.7 it looks like we would have been probably incurred, you know, hindsight looking back now. At that point, we said, you know, we didn't think there was any way we would, you know, with just the transformer, they would have gone this long before we could get the plant online. So that's why I guess when originally we didn't budget for the 2.7, only because we thought the timeline was going to work and the way the dates, everything lines up, work. And then again, we did, you know, kind of got caught again. Another whole another year went by, and but hopefully by 1st of July here, we're going to have to be generating.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just the brief comment. What is the economic life of the Coyote 2 plant, please?
We have a lease at the Port of Morro for 50 years with 10 more 5-year. We can up to 100 years.
Mr. Chairman, this is too early in the relationship for the honeymoon to be over. So I'm hoping that the parties can conclude some satisfactory negotiation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is Wednesday of next week, is that a fair time period for y'all to sit down with the other parties in this?
I'm afraid the party that I need to work with is going to be in Denver Monday night and Tuesday, and I'm not sure when he comes back. I can...
Thursday of next week? We just have to schedule the bail back.
Oh, I see. So, meeting actually here?
Well, whenever. I would leave it up to you, to the panel before you and yourselves, to figure out how you want to do that. but we'd just like to set some sort of date certain that we'll bring the bill back to act on the bill, and I think it'd be in all of our interests.
Mr. Chair, again, Jim Anderson, if you would allow me, I will try to bring as many parties on my side together as I possibly can and get a possible earliest date for such a meeting to take place and get it to staff so that you will know, and I'll try to get that done tomorrow.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the investment in Oregon and time this afternoon.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your time.
You're fine. Okay, good. Mr. Shipwreck, and whoever you want to bring.
There's two Mr. Shipwrecks.
There is not two Mr. Shipwrecks.
His son is here, too.
Oh, my God.
I've had brother.
What?
There's some pictures for you to look at.
Okay.
There's some pictures for you to look at. So, Bob, we have 20 to 30 minutes. I don't know the committee's time frame they're working in. If y'all could take maybe 10 or 15.
I'm going to try and be as brief as possible because there's a lot of people here to talk about this. I'm Bob Shipwreck. I'm Secretary of the Oregon Building and Construction Trades Council. I represent construction workers throughout the state of Oregon. The pictures there are about 3 weeks old. Those were at the parking lot at the Wana paper machine in Clatsop County of the out-of-state construction workers that are beginning to show up there. There's probably a lot more there. We'll go get some more pictures pretty quick. I'm here today, however, to offer an amendment to House Bill 2299. It's the B-14 amendments. And if it's drafted the way legislative council told me they would, a authorized business firm described in ORS 285 is that's the trigger for requiring local hiring, I believe, and that trigger is an investment of $25 million or more in a singular project. So that's what this would do. So for those projects of $25 million or more, part of the deal would be that the state prevailing wage law would apply to the construction of those projects. It currently is not required. And I'll talk to you as to why, very briefly, why I'm here to do this. And the reason I wanted to open up just by saying I think it's time the legislature, as the policy-making body, or of the branch of government, I should say,
takes a real hard look at what this enterprise zone legislation has done and what it's doing. I certainly support the use of them, but there has been some problems, and as a policy issue, I think it's incumbent on the legislature to look at the programs and see if they can't be implemented in a fashion that was serves the original intent. And I was here to vote on the first enterprise zone bill. It was Senator Carter's for her district, and it was there to provide jobs, badly needed jobs, for Northeast Portland. Currently, what happens, you'll have a, and Mike and others from the department can explain it, but what we see is you've got a company that wants to site in Oregon. That's great. They go to the county and or city, and they'll talk to the state and get an enterprise zone established, or perhaps there's already one that exists to incite their project. They then get either usually a 3 or 5 year tax abatement, property tax abatement. And they're pretty big. I was interested that the assessor from Hermiston, or I should say Umatilla County, was here. I was going to say they gave Calpine $17 million in tax breaks. He said it was 16. He had the number. A recent new project, the Georgia Pacific paper mill at Wana, according to the Daily Astorian, it's worth about $12 million in property tax breaks. That was a quote from the Clatsop County assessor that I read over a new tissue machine that is going in that area. This is private works, so there's no requirement that's binding on the local hiring requirements. And some people have alleged to this about, you know, how you can get local hiring. We all kind of thought we had that, but over a succession of court decisions and an attorney general's opinion from Oregon, requiring local hiring apparently violates the Commerce Clause of the Constitution. You can't say you have to hire people locally. So you go, well, maybe you hire them out of the unemployment office or some other source. You can say that, but anybody can sign up at a state unemployment office. So I've been trying to work on an issue of trying to get local hire of construction workers, and I keep running into this prohibition. So I've decided the only real good way to try and get local hiring on the construction of these facilities is to tie the prevailing wage law to this. And I'll tell you why. At the project that was described just here, the Calpine project in Hermiston, about 75% of the workers on that project were from out of state, many from the deep south, like the license plates I've showed you there.
Bob, do you know how many or what percentage do we know that on that project were from out of state or from the south?
No, there was a 75% were, and John actually has the exact numbers that were right for that project.
That project came up before the Energy Facility Siting Council. They asked them to produce numbers, and 32 out of 127 construction workers were hired locally by the prime contractor. And I'm going to submit some of that Energy Council proceedings as an exhibit.
We're going to come right back.
The same contractor that did the Calpine project in Hermiston was awarded the bulk of the work at the Wana paper machine recently, the Industrial Corporation out of Steamboat Springs, Colorado. So we're expecting the same ratio of out-of-state workers there on that project. Because these are private works, they can use who they want. They can pick and choose. But one of the bidders on the piping, at least, a local Oregon contractor, they've been in business in Oregon for 80 years, Harder Mechanical Company. I was talking to him. I says, you know, you didn't get the bid. And he says, you know, what the problem was, Bob, is it was a prevailing wage issue. I can't compete with Southern wages, was his comment. And the electrical contractor on that project, or who was hopeful to get the work, Electrical Construction Company, also from Northwest Portland, been in business for about the same time, cited the same reasons. So I got to thinking that maybe this is the right way to go. If it's a root prevailing wage issue on this type of work, then something needs to be done. We're figuring about 350 to 400 jobs at WANA. These were basically electricians and pipe fitters. I got some numbers yesterday just to show you what the construction economy is like in Oregon. And this is just in the Portland local of the electricians. Yesterday they had 720 journeyman electricians on the out-of-work list and 60 apprentices. This morning at the pipe plumbers and pipe fitters hall, there were 760 pipe fitters out of work and 90 apprentices and almost 400 plumbers to boot. There were a lot of our folks literally waiting for this job, sitting on the out-of-work list that lived down there. We ran numbers in both Clatsop and Columbia County. 44% and 47% of those folks were out of work that belonged, in this case, to the pipe fitters that were really waiting to go to work there. So what the situation you have is you have local residents do not get hired, while at the same time they're living in tax districts giving away tax breaks. I was somewhat heartened to hear the previous conversation you've had, because I've yet to hear a lot of folks at the city and county level talk about the loss of revenues. And here, in fact, today, this is real money. This is real taxpayer money that is being forgone, that goes to schools and running local and county government, that is not collected in order to entice someone, which is fine to entice. But don't you think, as a public policy, they owe something back? And we're asking if you inserted by statute that they at least have to pay the prevailing wages on the construction workers, at least the contractors here in Oregon would have a good opportunity of getting that work and employing local construction workers. I want to give you a little very short history. There was a repeal effort of prevailing wage in 1994, which was handily defeated. The public supports prevailing wages. I should mention the measure lost in every county of the state. Every single county voted against repealing prevailing wage law. However, in 1995, I stepped up, came to the legislature, and said, you know, if there's a perception that the state prevailing wage law does not accurately reflect the true wages and fringes that people work for around this state, then I'm going to fix that. So we worked with the Bureau of Labor Commissioner Roberts, who's here today, and the Employment Department. Today we survey construction workers in 14 districts around the state. The wages are changed every 6 months if they need to be, and they're resurveyed every year to, in fact, reflect what is the genuine wage and fringe package for construction workers around the state. I want to tell you, it's not always union. So I'm not here saying that if you do this, it's all going to be union wages. It's not, because that's not reflective. But at least it's honest. So it's logical, in my opinion, to require the law to apply to these large projects to secure Oregon jobs. There's one other thing that's a downside. I just want to share this with you, because this situation I'm describing also has a big political impact, as well as an economic development impact. There was a proposal to build a powerhouse in Central Oregon. The public was so upset over the local hire issue, as well as some environmental issues, that I believe two county commissioners didn't make it in the last election. In the city of Turner, there was a huge issue over, again, local hire issues and other issues, usually environmental. The mayor was turned out of office, and I believe one other city councilman. So you've got a situation that's brewing that I don't like, in that you've got people around the state angry enough about these issues that they're being anti-growth, and they don't want to build these things anymore, which I think I certainly don't want to go to that area. We're in a deep recession, and every effort must be made to provide jobs and work for Oregonians. And I'll stop there. I just want to reiterate, though, that the link I'm trying to establish here is that just as if there were direct public funds into a project, which would make it a prevailed job. These indirect tax abatements are the same thing, in my opinion, and it should at least require the prevailing wages be paid to these folks, and hopefully prevent some of the things that have went on here and are continuing to go on. I'll answer any questions.
That's true.
Thank you. Senator Corcoran.
So, Bob, what do you think, or maybe one of your other folks is going to talk about this, but in terms of your experience looking at the two examples that you used in construction and thinking about the local guy who didn't get the job because of the prevailing wage, what do you think the difference was in that southern wage versus what... I mean, first of all, they're going to pay somebody from another state that's going to take that money home. It's not going to be here.
Yep.
But I'm curious as to the scope of the difference between prevailing wage and what these guys were getting paid to do that construction work, for instance.
The southern wage earners or the local wage earners?
The southern wage earners. I'm just trying to figure out. This guy lost a bid, and he told you that he lost the bid because of the issue of... southern wages, and I was just curious: is it 20% lower, 40% lower?
I don't know. It's not that much. It's not 40%. Clearly, what one of the problems that they do on these jobs is you can manipulate the wage by having scheduled overtime, and oftentimes what they'll do with these folks is they'll have what we call travel and subsistence packages that are well above what we have, maybe $60-$70 a day. Well, that doesn't. It's not reflected in your wage rate, but it cashes.
It never did, yeah.
Mr. Endicott says he thinks he knows what the wage differential is.
Yeah, Chair Gekert.
We need.
You have to, Diana.
We need you on the mics. Okay.
Chair Deckard, I'm John Endicott. I'm the business manager of Plumbers and Steam Fitters Local 290. I represent about 4,300 plumbers and pipe fitters in the state of Oregon. And in spending time looking at the WANA project, I just heard today they're bringing folks on site. Our welders have a base rate of around $33 an hour with about a $10, $11 an hour benefit package. They were offering welding jobs at that site for $15 an hour.
Wow.
And $30 a day subsistence. That's what we're up against.
Okay.
Thank you.
Number.
Are you good, or do you have...
I just wanted to just say one thing in closing, and I think it's an ethical thing I need to declare, I'm forced to bring up the Georgia-Pacific WANA mill because it was an example that has exacerbated this problem. The decisions that were created here were based in Atlanta, Georgia, and I hold no ill will to the local people at WANA or the lobbyists for Georgia-Pacific. That's a very truthful. I just want you to know.
Thank you.
This was all done.
Thank you. Jeff, did you want to...
Go ahead, John.
Chair Deckert, members of the committee, my name's John Paul Williams. I've provided my written testimony. I'd just like to touch a few high points. I spent years, decades studying these kinds of impacts, and specifically regarding recent construction projects in Oregon Enterprise Zones, everyone was grateful for the extra 100 jobs we got when U.S. Gypsum built in Rainier. But what about the 800 construction jobs that went to out-of-state workers? These are lost opportunities for Oregon jobs. We're happy about the 25 jobs at the Calpine Power Plant in Hermiston. But what about the 600 construction jobs that could have gone to Oregon workers? And so it goes. And not only is there just a lost construction job, there's a lost multiplier effect, because when you hire local construction workers, 90% of the pay is spent locally. And for every construction job that's created, there's 1 to 3 jobs created in secondary industries. So we're seeing hundreds of jobs that are potentially lost. Another lost opportunity is without a prevailing wage requirement at these within these enterprise zones, we're losing an opportunity for training of our young people. One out of three or one out of four of those construction jobs could be going to apprentices and training the next generation. But that's not happening on those enterprise zone construction jobs currently. And there's added community costs when there's an imported construction crew. Some of them are bringing their children. Some of them are going on welfare. Some of them are ending up in jail. And they're all, those are all added costs of social services coming from these projects taking place in enterprise zones. And my experience, which is longer, going on 20 years of this kind of research, when I started researching this issue of imported construction crews, we saw crews that were 30 to 50% from out of the area 15, 20 years ago. Now, as I said, the Energy Council proceedings discovered that at the Calpine plant, 75% of the employees were imported. And I just saw some other hard data that showed that 85% of the construction workers at the site were from out of the local area. So it's a problem that's getting worse. It's lost opportunities for Oregonians, and we feel like prevailing wages would be a way of correcting this problem. I have several studies that show that institution of prevailing wages will increase the local hiring rate, and I would like for construction projects like to provide it to the committee. Thank you very much.
Chair, thank you very much.
I'll be very brief. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Carlson. I represent the International Association of Bridge Structural, Ornamental, and Reinforcing Ironworkers, Local 29. I'm here today to support the Dash B14 amendments to House Bill 2299. The handout you're receiving dispels the myth that prevailing wage rates will escalate construction costs and chase business away. The myth is, and this is a study from Dr. Peter Phillips. He's an economist with the University of Utah. Without the constraints of Little Davis Bacon, we could build four schools instead of three for the same amount of money. That was New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson in 1996. The fact is, for all school types, square foot construction costs were cheaper in prevailing wage law states. And Dr. Phillips did a national study on this issue. The fact that labor costs only equal 28% of total costs, contractor profit and cost of material components and suppliers are the majority of the total cost. If wages are cut, labor pool training and skill level will decrease. That's a fact, and negatively affect productivity. I got a brother that's an iron worker. He's working down in San Diego right now. He lives on the coast, and this Wana project would have been a pretty good shot for him, but he's missed an opportunity there. And that's what happens when skilled workforce loses opportunity. They go someplace else, and right now San Diego is good for iron workers. I actually visited that Wana mill, and I talked with a construction worker from Alabama. He makes $18 an hour with no benefits. He has a family, and he sends money home each week. He sends the money to Alabama, dollars that are not going to be reinvested in Oregon for Oregon business. Now, if this guy gets hurt on the job, he's covered by workers' comp. But if he gets sick or knocked off a bar stool and has to have his head stitched up, guess who pays his medical bills? We do. Supporting the Dash B14 amendments will stop the practice of importing cheap labor. Oregon will retain a highly skilled workforce, and dollars earned in Oregon will stay in Oregon. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Jeff. I guess I just have one question, and the answer is probably really brief, but it's, if I'm that vice president in Atlanta, for example, and I'm just looking at the entire nation, and I spent very little time in Oregon versus Montana versus Wisconsin versus Florida, and I have to make a decision. If we adopt this amendment, I think the opponents of this amendment would state pretty unequivocally, if I'm that person, I just skip Oregon. I don't look, I just skip it. And maybe
someone might care to...
Chair Deckard, if they really look at the issue, like the handout I gave you, the cost per square foot, and they used the school as an example, and I can imagine that the industrial site wouldn't be a whole lot different, that you actually, the costs are it's more cost-effective with prevailing wage in effect, mm-hmm. as the study indicates.
Okay. Thank you.
I just wanted to comment, Mr. Chairman. I don't think that factor is really a factor in these decision-making things because of the productivity issues and others. The other thing that that happens, and I think I'm safe in saying it, the company that offered the low bid in this case, I'm not aware of them at the end of the job that bid was still good. In other words, there were additional monies put in because of cost overruns. So that's another factor.
You talked about this one particular. Mm-hmm.
Is there a way, Mr. Chair, is there a way to get at that information, like the information you got through the, I can't remember the name, that when you said that you got from the records of an energy board?
I don't know. The cost of the projects?
Senator Deckard, Chair Deckard, Senator Cochran, that would only apply to power plant production. That's the only way that particular record happened to be made public.
Right, but I'm in regard to that, my question is, could you get at that question of whether the bid stood good or there were overruns? Is that public record as well?
The Energy Council record was restricted to the amount of local hires.
I see.
That information was provided in the notebook that I just submitted as an exhibit.
So it's not really, that's not a get-attable number necessarily.
Well, regarding that particular contract, there are voluminous court suits regarding their problems in other jobs and ability to complete jobs on time and on budget.
So that would probably indicate there's a paper trail.
Thank you very much. Appreciate
Thank you.
Your patience. Georgia Pacific. And if you are here and will not be here when we rehear this, let me know so we make sure we get you in. So that would mean if you're not usually in the building.
I'm usually here, so if there's people that aren't here, I can always.
That would be fantastic.
Jack actually has a real job in Eugene.
Yeah, why don't you come on?
Commissioner Roberts, would you like to?
We're not getting any economic development done in Eugene with Jack Roberts sitting up here. Let's get him up here and get it done. Sure.
Thank you. Georgia Pacific, if you'd like to lead off.
Chair Decker, Senators, my name is Dick Winger. I'm Vice President, Resident Manager at the Wana Mill at Clatskanie that we've been hearing about. Just briefly, about 10 months ago, I was down here with our CEO from Atlanta with then-Governor Kitzhaber to celebrate the announcement that Georgia Pacific planned to invest $200 million to create 110 new jobs at the Wana Mill in the Clatskanie area, those jobs averaging about $60,000 a year. A major boon to the mill, a major commitment by the company, and something that we're all committed to make very successful. 10 months later, I'm happy to report that we're about a third done with the construction. We're on schedule. We plan to finish soon after the end of this year and bring that project online. Hopefully, and find a market that's willing to buy the product, which it isn't today as well as it has been. To date, 87% of the contract labor that's been out there is local. Our forecast, our prediction, our commitments from the contractors we're hiring that when we're finished, 85% of the work done out there will be done by local workers. We're not importing people from out of state with the exception of one specific part of that project, a very specific machine erection. The same crew that erected the identical machine in Louisiana was contracted to do it here because of their experience and their expertise with it. And the supplier of that paper machine rated it as best seen to date, and they've had installed hundreds of paper machines across the world. And this crew did it great, and we decided to take advantage of that. That's the current out-of-state plates that you may have saw some pictures of, and that's maybe 15 or 20 workers out of a total of 117 out there at this time. So that's kind of a current status of where we're at. a little bit about Georgia Pacific. It's not just the lumber company anymore. 3 years ago, they bought what used to be Crownsiller back and became James River, which became Fort James. That included the Wanna Mill and the Halsey Mill. Currently, GP has 3,000 employees in the state of Oregon. We pay property tax of about $11 million a year and a payroll of about $200 million a year in the state of Oregon. So we're here to stay. We're committed to being a part of the community, and we want Oregon to be successful. We believe the enterprise zone exemption is an important part for this state to have out there to incent us and other businesses and companies to invest in Oregon going forward. We believe we'll deliver on that investment as we have in the past. Wanna was built 38 years ago and has been a major boon to that area when many others have come and gone. So we're here to stay. We're here to build Oregon. We want it to be successful. The amendments that's before you today will be a red flag, and I think you hit it right on the nose. It will be a reason not to consider. When Georgia Pacific bought our company, we had plans to put that machine in. The first commitment from them was we'll never put it in the Northwest. And through comparing how we can run paper machines and what we could do with it, where the market was at, we convinced them to consider. And then we went through a lot of work to show that we could do this competitively, and our ability to contract this competitively was a key piece of that. GP is the general contractor on that. We let out the different phases in lump sum bids, as opposed to most big projects, you hire a general contractor, go on time and materials. We are controlling the cost of this project very closely, and if there's overruns on a fixed bid, as you know, those overruns are absorbed by the contractor, not by the party. So we're very much committed to bringing this project at or under budget and making it successful going forward. We only hire contractors that have a good safety record, that have proven they can do the quality of work, and will deliver us good value for the money that we're paying them. So that's the same basis that we've led all the contracts to date. And to date, we've been vast majority union versus non-union. This next phase that was referred to, the successful bidder was non-union. His commitment to us is that they're going to hire locally to the maximum extent possible, and they believe that will be 85 to 90% of their workers. So there's the facts as I know them today, and I'd be glad to respond to any questions you might have.
Sure. Thank you for coming. Yes, Senator Corcoran.
The only question I have, sir, is you said that you had to convince the company to build in the Northwest when they said they would never do that. What was their reason for not doing it?
Because the belief is in the paper industry that the Southeast is where growth can happen. You can install sites, you can install manufacturing capability at a lower cost down there, and generally the operating labor rates are lower down there. Cost of construction in Oregon is higher, no fault of our own or Mr. Shipwreck's. We're in an earthquake zone. We have to build things a bit more sturdy in this area than you do in other parts of the country. Things like the enterprise zone exemption give us the ability to overcome some of those obstacles that we face in doing that. They have been an Atlanta-based company since they moved out of Portland 20-some years ago or 30 years ago. I don't remember the exact date. Their focus is in the Southeast. That's where all their expansion has been. And it was very, if you look around, you haven't seen paper machine expansions in the Northwest in the last 15 or 20 years. It's not just Georgia Pacific. It's the industry. This was a major exception. And my belief is our success on this project will not only send a signal to Georgia Pacific, it's a signal also to pulp and paper industry that you still can't be competitive in the Northwest. So it's very much important to us as a mill, important to us as a company, but it's also important to the industry and to the state.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I got to go to Rules Committee. I'm sorry.
Mr. Robertson.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Jack Roberts. I am the Executive Director of the Lane Metro Partnership, an economic development private nonprofit in Eugene, Springfield area. I'm formerly State Labor Commissioner, and for 8 years was responsible for setting prevailing wage rates in the state of Oregon. I also worked with Mr. Shipwreck in 1995 to reform our system here, to bring our wage rates more in line with the market, to make the system work better. And I am to this day a very strong supporter of our prevailing wage rate system. However, I don't support the B-14 amendments that would require prevailing wage rate be paid on these projects that qualify for enterprise zone. And there are really two reasons for that. First of all, I don't think it's appropriate to require prevailing wage rate to be paid on private jobs. I think one of the principal reasons why prevailing wage rate is important for public works jobs is that public agencies are required under our public contracting law to award bids to the lowest bidder. And consequently, they don't have the ability to make some judgment calls about who might be coming in and having a low bid purely on the basis of low wages, because they can't take into consideration their past work experience, their own assessment of the quality of the workforce, and other things, which private contractors and private jobs can do. As evidence that that is a difference, I would point to the surveys that we have done on contracting wages over the last 7 years through the Employment Department, which show that about the same percentage of work on private jobs is union as is the case in public works jobs. That tells me that union contractors can compete about as well on private jobs where you don't have the protection of prevailing wage rate, because they can compete on the basis of productivity and quality workmanship. Now, I realize that for the most part what you've been hearing is not union versus non-union, but in-state versus out-of-state, but I would suggest to you that most people don't go out-of-state to bring in union contractors, and that I think that the reality is that our in the private sector, our union contractors are able to compete. Secondly, and more importantly, it has to do with the enterprise zone and what I think it really is intended to accomplish. It is not and shouldn't be seen as a windfall for business or a benefit for business. I think it should be seen primarily, and I would say almost exclusively, as a way for us to compete for the investment here in Oregon rather than elsewhere. That's why we limit it primarily to manufacturing, wholesale distributors, and others who could locate anywhere, and we want to get their investment here in Oregon. And the unfortunate truth is that if you add this component into our enterprise zone statutes, it basically takes away with one hand what we've given with the other. We don't have as many tools in this state as a lot of other places have when it comes to trying to attract investment and attract jobs here. The enterprise zone is one of them. If we have to explain to people that in order to qualify for the enterprise zone, they have to pay prevailing wage rate, which to many people who aren't familiar with Oregon, what they think of is the federal Davis-Bacon wages, which generally run about 20 to 25% above market wages. And if they're factoring in their mind that kind of increased cost and the construction cost up front to build the project with the idea of some relief on the property tax spread out over 3 to 5 years, I think there are an awful lot of people who will stop listening at that point. Our ability to compete for jobs and investment is important. That's why the governor has made the industrial lands issue a top priority. That's why he's made reinvigorating economic development a top priority. That's why we're trying to do what we can to be competitive again. This measure, I'm afraid, would cut into that. And the final point I want to make, and I don't want to hit this too hard, but I think we have to keep it in mind. When we're talking about investments in Clatsop County and investments in Halsey and the mills there, and we're talking now about projects where you have a $25 million or more investment, by and large, those aren't going to be Clatsop County or Halsey contracting companies that are going to get those bids. Most of those large bids are going to Portland companies. And there is, I think, a sense some people would have that this is saying to the rural areas, we don't want to allow economic development to occur there unless Portland gets its bite of the apple, unless it gets its pound of flesh and it gets the contracting. That's one of these things that I don't have to tell you particularly, not you guys, how that's tearing the state apart. And I would urge you not to cloud the issue of enterprise zones by putting this requirement into the law.
Thank you.
Chairman Deck, Senators, my name is Dan O'Brien. I'm president of Kern Electrical Construction Company in Portland. We are an open shop electrical contractor. We today are employing one-third the workforce that we had together here 2 years ago. We went down a third last year, and we're down another third this year. We pay our employees a significant wage as far as our package is concerned. Our employees make $25.50 an hour. They have a full health care program. They have a full vacation program. They have two retirement programs. At a total package cost of somewhere around $34.54. prevailing wage for an electrical contractor going to a public works project moves that rate to close to $43, and that does not include the 17% add for the state employment taxes and various employment taxes you need to put on top of it. So when you add the total package together, you're between $13 and $15 an hour using our package as a base. Last year, most of our electricians made better than $50,000 on the year. This year, they probably won't do that because the amount of work is not of it. And by the way, I'm very much in support of this bill. Let's get it out there and get some people in here building some projects. We just don't have the opportunity to employ these people right now. We're finding most of the projects that we've talked about here today are also licensed craft projects. So every one of those employees, and we're talking about electricians, and steam fitters, pipe fitters, those people, they have to be licensed in the state of Oregon. So they have to go through the process in the state, go through and take their tests, make sure that they pass the test, and then they're given the license by the state to actually work on these projects. So we're talking about a little bit different type of process on those projects that we've been talking about so far today. The bigger issue for me is the fact that the prevailing wage isn't set in place right now. We just went through a change of commissioners, and there's going to be some modifications coming up that we're going to have to look at very closely, and I hope that the legislature is very much involved in that. In 1993, I was involved with a representative from AGC to submit the prevailing wage bill. It was an idea that was presented by AGC to the legislature. Organized labor was very much opposed to that. But as a result of an issue to turn Davis-Bacon out in 1994, the organized labor actually came to the table and came together in a joint session and presented the prevailing wage package as it is now. This would be a poor idea to increase the cost of investment in the state of Oregon with numbers that I gave you, and I know that goes quite across the 40 crafts that actually participate in construction projects. We don't need to increase the construction project cost for the owners that are coming into the state. Thank you.
How do you respond, and I haven't vetted that Utah study, but the study that says from the previous testimony that if you look at the end of the project, and Commissioner, you might want to jump in on this, that ultimately you're going to have cost savings. It seems to contradict.
Michelle, let me say that because, again, they're looking at public works jobs where you otherwise have to take the low bidder, and I think you don't have the same kind of cost control. I think those studies are correct. What I have a problem with is telling private contractors and private businesses that we know better than they do what the wage rates are they should be paying and how they can protect themselves against that. I think there's just a different standard for public works jobs than there is for the private sector jobs. I think prevailing wages is important in the public works area. I don't think we ought to be extending that to private areas.
Is there precedent in other states for...
I'm not aware of any other state that has this kind of requirement. Now, maybe they're aware of that. I'm not aware of anyone else who makes this a requirement for any kind of incentive program.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time. Anyone else not regularly in the building? If not, I'll just start going, Steve, you're regularly here. I see you all the time.
Well, I sure hope you don't, because I'm no longer a Vista's corporate lobbyist in Salem. I can tell my mother what I do, and... Steve Vincent, representing the Oregon Economic Development Association. Avista has loaned me to this association for about the last 5-6 years to try and advocate for good public policy. And unfortunately, in the last 4 or 5 months, I've met with about a half a dozen site selectors from Deloitte Touche, Cushman Wakefield. I'll be in New York next week to meet with site selectors to encourage them to move their clients to Oregon. And I can tell you without a doubt that site selectors eliminate us. They don't look to identify states. They look to eliminate states when they begin their search. And this is an easy one. They're going to thank us for this because they're going to say you made our jobs easier by helping us to eliminate you. Most of the time when a site selector contacts the state to gather information, they're looking for a way to eliminate that state. And we're not going to have a chance to explain what prevailing wage is. They're going to see prevailing wage just as former Commissioner Roberts explained. They may be confused with the federal rate, but regardless of what it is, if you intend to adopt the amendment, then I'll cancel my trip to New York because there really won't be a point in going. I have 3 projects in the Medford area. One company, food products company out of San Francisco, that is considering a move to Medford. It was a result of a contact in L.A. at a trade show that we made. 700 employees, a $35, $40 million project. They're looking at us, and they're looking at Nevada. And Nevada doesn't have this prevailing wage requirement. And I can tell you without
any doubt that we will lose that project in a heartbeat in the event that this amendment is adopted, because they're not going to make the decision tomorrow. They'll probably make it in the next several months to the next 6 months by the time that this bill is signed into law. And I've called my counterpart with the city of Medford, and he's assured me that we'll lose that project as a result of this amendment.
Without question.
Without question. Because and my boss actually met with the owners of the company in Medford 2 weeks ago. If they move, they're not going to bring all 700 employees with them. They'll bring executives, owners, and they'll hire the rest locally to manufacture their product. And I'd like to see those jobs in the Medford area. It certainly helped diversify our economy away from, you know, traditionally timber resource-based economy. And I can be sure that they would go somewhere else. We contacted a company in L.A. when we were there in February that was looking at Nevada, Arizona, and Oregon, and they chose Nevada over Oregon because there's more land, there are more incentives. And the enterprise zone incentive is a good incentive, but this would eliminate our ability to continue to use it effectively.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Chair Deckert and committee, my name is Terry Hatch. I'm with the National Electrical Contractors Association. I represent about 250 electrical contractors up and down the corridor, and about 1,700 electricians and apprentices. I've been sitting here through this process and listening to. I've got a couple things I wanted to respond to. One of the comments that was made by GP was the fact that they like to build their plants in the South, and I think that's really important for you guys to understand that a lot of the reasons that these companies like to locate in the South is because he admittedly said that it's cheaper for them to build those plants there, and there's a big reason why. I'm formerly from Idaho. I grew up in Idaho and moved to Oregon about 5 years ago. One of the reasons that I am in Oregon rather than Idaho is because of some real short-sighted thinking on behalf of the legislature and the people that make our laws. There's a big push by companies and corporations to water down the prevailing rates. In Idaho, when they killed the prevailing rates, it really made a huge impact to the economic stability of the state. I owned a construction company there, and I relocated to Oregon because I simply could not compete. Once the prevailing rates are gone, nobody's setting the bar. How low can you go? And I think it's really important that the committee understand that. Our standard of living in Oregon is great, and we need to maintain the prevailing rates. I'm here to support the concepts contained in HB 2299. We need it, and we need it now. In fact, we worked with Bob Shipwreck and other members of the construction industry on the economic development legislation, which has been passed. Streamlining and permitting are only one side of the issue. NECA is concerned about the enterprise zones and whether they return the jobs and stimulus. They should. We support the amendments. Prevailing wage rate on major projects makes sense. Why? Oregonians pay the taxes that are used to encourage this investment. Oregon taxpayers pick up the cost for all the related development. Oregonians are leading the nation in unemployment among those who want to work, and Oregon is last in job creation. This amendment says it loud and clearly by Oregon. Oregon has a trained workforce. Oregon has ready workers. Oregonians are providing the tax dollars to those who want to develop. It does not require union jobs, but it takes away the incentive to bring in low-wage jobs from other states and displace taxpayers who want those jobs. NECA contractors are underbid by out-of-state contractors who come here with cheap labor, predominantly from the South, to take our jobs. While we provide training, health care, and good wages, these outsiders take our tax dollars, take our jobs, dump their employees' health care issues on our public systems, and leave the state with the money. It's Oregonians who provide the taxes to create the enterprise zones. And if they're to be used, then wages and benefits should be considered as part of the package. If the opposition to this amendment doesn't like the Buy Oregon concept, they should stop promoting it. If the opposition doesn't like the prevailing wage concept, they should not accept taxpayer subsidies. Then they could develop a project just like any other private job where they can bring in low-wage workers, not worry about wages, benefits, training, and working conditions. They will still have an adverse impact on the community, but we cannot legislate responsibility and common sense. Buy Oregon. employ Oregonians, and use tax benefits wisely to support job creation and in a manner that benefits those who pay the taxes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Questions?
Okay, so I'll go right down the list. If you don't wish to testify, just let me know. Doug Riggs does want to testify. Patrick does want to testify. And John Williams has already testified. Right. Steve Hubbard?
Mr. Chairman, I'll defer for a later date and time if we're going to bring this back, because I'm in the building every single day.
We might not, so this might be your chance in terms of a hearing.
Okay.
You heard.
I'll go and make it quick. Senator Decker, for the record, Patrick Green with the Oregon AFL-CIO. I just wanted to come up and testify in favor of the amendments presented by Bob Shiprack with the building trades in terms of bringing on the requiring prevailing wage. And as you know, we've testified before, we've come sort of a long way in terms of the enterprise zone program in terms of the ability for it to attract businesses. This has been a change for us that we've been echoing throughout the session. We completely agree with Bob Shiprack's notion that these are tax dollars. They are a tax expenditure. The public does have an interest for these jobs to be not only Oregon jobs, but to pay a decent wage. With that, I'll just say that we, you know, I know that we're running long, but we support the amendments.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Mr. Chairman and committee members who are not here, I guess I can't say members of the committee. What I've handed out is a summary of Oregon's unemployment rate, and I'll allow you to look through it at your leisure. But as you'll notice, if you flip towards the end, what you'll see, for the record, Doug Riggs here representing NECA. What you'll notice if you flip to about the fourth page is we've got a list of the unemployment rate by state dated March of 2003. And if you flip all the way down to the very bottom, you'll find Oregon at 7.6%. We're now over 8%. And we remain one of only two states with unemployment rates above 7%, the other being Washington. And I think that a point that Mr. Shiprack echoed earlier in the testimony is worth repeating, which is that in the construction trades, unemployment is between 35 and 45%, depending on the craft. That's significant. I also wanted to make a couple points. If you refer back to the handout that Mr. Burton provided, and you look at page 5, which is the summary sheet of what are Oregon enterprise zones, I want to point out three sentences that I underlined. In the very top bullet, the purpose, the last sentence in the quote is stimulate sound business investments that support and improve the quality of life. And I would argue that that ought to take place during the construction phase as well as the operational phase. Go down about four bullets to local determination, the last sentence, use enterprise zones to create better economic opportunities. And then lastly, at the local application and designation phase down at the very bottom, or the unemployment rate is 2% each points or higher above the comparable state unemployment rate. So clearly, I think OECDD believes that this ought to be helpful to the local quality of life economic situation. And I think that based on the experience that we have seen TIC and other locations, particularly the Calpine plant, when construction fully commenced, the rate of employment from out-of-state workers went to 75 to 80%. So I cannot comment specifically on the numbers that we heard earlier. I'd like to take a little closer look at them. But from the anecdotal evidence that we have in the past, we have seen a significant impact from out-of-state labor.
Doug, are you concerned at all what, I forget what Steve Benson said, which is the folks he talks to, without question, in terms of the unemployment data that's on page one, without question would not locate here?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I don't necessarily believe that to be true. I think that's one factor. Labor rates are one factor in making a determination. We at PacWest represent business and labor. We've had a very good track record of working together with business and labor, and it hasn't precluded the interest of a number of companies in locating inside the state, so I'm not sure I'd agree with that. And the other thing is I think that if I'm a business manager looking at the state, I want to make sure that the product that I produce is a good product and operates efficiently. What we heard earlier from the earlier amendment is that some of the problems that we had from importing goods from out of the country have led to higher costs. And we see the same thing in the labor market. When you import on the Calpine plant, they imported pipe fitters from Argentina. And they had a number of troubles directly as a result of those pipe fitting problems that were developed as a result of that. So I'm not convinced that people automatically say, no, I will not locate in Oregon for that purpose.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Jessica Jolie.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Julie Brandes with Associated Oregon Industries. As you know, many of our members, as are many of your constituents, are struggling with the economy. And often when businesses are looking to make a decision about where to site, they look for those tools that make a site more competitive, such as an enterprise zone. And in today's world, companies are not only competing with other companies to produce that widget or whatever the case might be, but as you have pointed out, Mr. Chair, they are competing with their own individual sites in different states. And this is something that we as lobbyists at AOI have been educated quite a bit about in the last year. And so these companies, when looking for expansion or production or sites, will look at all sorts of factors, as Mr. Riggs said, when making these big decisions, energy rates, tax credits, enterprise zones. And I think putting something like a prevailing wage requirement on private construction would send a red flag, an enormous red flag, to private companies looking to expand. As you know, the state creates the enterprise zones, and it's my understanding that in the bill, and I think it's on page 4, local governments can set some standards for the hiring requirements, and I haven't had a chance to completely read the bills that hadn't been on my radar screen until about yesterday. But I think when you take a look at that and you take a look at the long-term need for enterprise zones and for expansions of jobs and family wage jobs, you look at 110 new jobs in the Wana area, and that's pretty important to a coastal community. Those are long-term jobs. They're investments, and they're investments in the community, and it has an enormous payoff. And that would be a huge loss to that community if that enormous red flag had shot up before. The other, just to point out, we went on a member tour the other day, which is something we're required to do as lobbyists. We go meet with a bunch of our members throughout the year. I wasn't on this tour, but what the company told us is when they look to expand and to invest into their site, they are looking at an enterprise zone, but they mostly now look to Arizona and Texas and that area because the costs are already higher here in Oregon, and they pointed to labor rates and energy rates and those types of items. So I think having a competitive enterprise zone is really important for our for a long-term investment in jobs here in Oregon.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for allowing us to testify, even though we're very late in the afternoon. For the record, my name is Jessica Harris. I'm here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. We represent almost 1,100 construction-related companies throughout Oregon and Southwest Washington. We are the largest commercial construction trade association. If anyone's going to be seeing the woes of labor and unemployment in the construction industry, it's going to be us. It's our companies that hope to build these projects when they come to Oregon, and it's our employees that reap those benefits, and we are struggling, as is labor, in order to keep our doors open. But our concern about this is it blurs the line between private and public construction. We are strong supporters of the prevailing wage system on the public side, and we'll defend that system and work to improve it as it needs improvement. But when you start to apply it on the private side, it doesn't work quite exactly the same way. We wonder, as the amendments are written, do they also intend for all the other requirements that come with the payment of prevailing wage on the public side to apply? There's a fee involved. There are certified weekly wage statements involved. There's oversight by BOLI that's involved. There are fines and review of records that are an incredible burden to a company beyond just the payment of the wage. And we wonder whether or not those requirements will also apply as a result of this amendment. As public contracting companies, my members are prepared to undertake those kinds of risks because that's part of doing that kind of work. But when you start to impose those on private side contractors who don't usually work on the public side, that will preclude people from being able to compete there. And we think especially of small minority contractors who will have a very difficult time coming in and working on some of these projects as subcontractors if a lot of these requirements apply and they get to be very cumbersome because they don't compete on the public side very well for those exact same reasons. It's our concern that these kinds of requirements are going to keep people out of this state. We see companies every day being turned away because of land use regulations or walking away because of tax environment. But this is one more thing. This just adds on another component as to why people wouldn't want to come here because of the regulation involved with locating and with dealing with wage requirements on what was supposed to be a private job. Our contractors who do private work are used to negotiating with owners about a wide variety of things, including labor choices and rates. This law on page 4 allows the local government to set those requirements with the owner coming in if that's what they choose to do. If not, then that's the decision the community has made. And I represent both union and open shop contractors. This isn't a union or an open shop issue for us, and we would love to have Oregon companies used in almost every instance, but that's the choice of the owner. This amendment won't create more local jobs. It doesn't do that straight out. It just sets a wage rate, and it may drive companies away. And so we don't, for that reason, for many others, we oppose this amendment.
Thank you very much.
Chairman Deckert, for the record, Rick Thomas with Independent Electrical Contractors of Oregon, representing the state's merit shop electrical contracting companies. First of all, I just want to start with the intent of Oregon's public contracting laws, as Ms. Harris said, and that's the fact that it covers public projects. It's meant to cover things like schools, libraries, prisons, state capital, and in all circumstances, those are subject to low bid rather than a competitive bid where the owner can choose. The contractor not bound by going with the low bid on the project.
I have a 3:45 that I have.
Okay. Well, we'll go as quickly as possible.
I want to make sure John gets...
No problem. By subjecting this to prevailing wage, one of my concerns is that we're not necessarily ensuring that we're going with local hire. We're by requiring that, we're setting a wage rate that may be local, but it's not in any way ensuring local hire. An example I'll point out was there was a power project that was taking place, I believe it was in Klamath County, about a year to a year and a half ago, where there were several Canadian electricians brought into the state to help man that project. And so while they were probably paid the wages we're stipulating here, we're not necessarily ensuring that there's a local hire provision. When times are good, sometimes that just happens. People have to come in from different areas to man work and things like that, and recognizing that. And then as some people have identified too, page 4, line 1 and 2, I think, also deal a little bit with the agreement by allowing the local governments that are involved to work with the owner of the project to negotiate other requirements for the project. Which
so is that after construction?
That's only after construction. Reading it, my understanding was that maybe for during construction too, because I think that was an issue that came up in
Tulare
County.
We'll get to that.
But with that, I'll complete my testimony.
Thank you.
Senator Deckert, John Killen for Associated Builders and Contractors. I will be as brief as possible. We support enterprise zones in general. We support attracting business and providing jobs. And we believe that these big construction projects lead to smaller construction projects and more good wage jobs for Oregonians. So in general, we don't think that the Dash 14s will do anything to get more development of the big projects into Oregon. And so we would oppose that part of it, but to support the rest of the bill.
That's the bill. Thank you. Good to see you, John, Rick. It's been a while.
Thank you.
Jared, please.
Thank you.
Is that it?
Chair Deckert, members of the absent committee, for the record, my name is Jared Broadfoot with PacWest Communications, here today representing the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association and the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors National Association. Would offer our support for the B14 amendments. We do feel that this will set the bar and prevent the low bid out-of-state jobs. If we're going to make the commitment for the enterprise zones, put the money in the state, give incentive to bring companies to the state, we ought to try our best to keep the money within the state. I just would caution you to the scare tactics that are used to scare away from these amendments, and look at the materials that were presented today. We've got a lot of factual information from academics, from scholars to deal with here, and I suggest that we look at those and base our decision on these amendments on facts and not scare tactics. So with that, I'll answer a question if you want me to.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your time. Thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2299. We'll probably bring this back 1 week from this afternoon and adjourn committee. You are adjourned.